right about the time.
It got desperate very fast. So many young people coming in and not working and just getting drugged and yeah.
Tripping out. It's like you hear all those stories about all the homeless people that like have been homeless since like 1975 in San Francisco. Like they came there during the 60s and then they just never got their feet off the ground. And they are like, their name's Jan and they're like a neighborhood favorite and everybody takes turns giving Jan food and like staying on the porch and like she's just like a neighborhood fixture. Like it's part of the hangover of that utopia, nostalgic utopia that we have created of that time. Or mostly it was just a place for lost individuals to either end it all or realize that they can actually do something with their lives.
That's interesting because, you know, I hadn't really thought about that, but of course, right? And it's interesting that you said that, you know, Jan is like a fixture in the neighborhood because my first thought is when people were analyzing, you know, like film in the 40s and 50s and saying it presented this, these ideas of perfect neighborhoods where everyone knows each other and white picket fences and, you know, Leave It to Beaver stuff and The Milkman and all that stuff. Like, what if you brought movies like that back but had heavy representation of the homeless people in it as well? Where it's like, hey, everybody knows each other in the neighborhood and then, you know, it's like family-friendly entertainment, but also half the cast are the homeless people in the street. But then there's the crazy ones, too, who are drug addicted and stuff. But you spin it that way, and otherwise it's just like a Leave It to Beaver kind of like, you know, pastiche. I think that would be a crazy fucking TV show or a movie.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Sounds good. No,
like,
I think
if you
want to
help
TV
the
homeless,
yeah, like if you want to help the homeless, go paint them into some, you know, utopian white picket fence idea of how they exist in that society while actually not, you know, getting shoved off to the shelter that you want to cross the street every time you get to that part of town, right? That's social constructionism done right. That's all I'm saying.
In L.A., you have the Skid Row, which is the only place in the world that it, like, actually is has city jurisdiction to be where homeless people live, and it's legal to live on in tents on the street in Skid Row. Like, it's legal, 100%. Like, that's what they made that place about in the beginning of the 70s. By the end of the 70s, when all of the manufacturing core started to close down, it was the end of the railway line from the Midwest. You can't go farther than L.A., right? So you have all these homeless people, and then they made it part of, it's like a neighborhood. It's like Skid Row. And you have, like, Maseratis, like, driving really slowly through crowds of, like, homeless people with shopping carts and, like, crazy, like, there's, like, three generations, some of the homeless people that lived on Skid Row. Like, their grandparents moved to Skid Row when they lost their job in, like, Indiana, and they just never left. They still live there. And it's,
right.
Like, you walk, it's amazing. It's one of the most surreal experiences because you're in the Arts District, which is at the bottom of it, which is, like, now, like, unreal expensive. I lived in a building that he bought for $2.2 million in 2001, and now it's worth, like, $38 million, which is pretty
–
it's a good – it's, like, not so bad. And it's not even that nice a building. But, like, anyways, and then you have that, and then you have downtown L.A., but then you have this Skid Row in between it. So you walk through it, and at night, there's just tent. You walk through it and you hear all the radios and they're watching the ball game and they're listening to the Latin story and everything's just totally silent, pristine, beautiful. Like you see the lights from their different electronics inside their tents kind of glowing and it's like this weird light show of vagabonds that have lived on the street their entire life with Maseratis driving past from gentrified to gentrified with this crazy gap in between. And obviously, it's like
yeah, of course.
There's... It's crazy. It's really insane. Yeah.
But it's really interesting to listen to your insights. Because, yeah, it's like I was there, but it's not the same to go as a tourist. And just see, like...
Yeah.
Like a more idealized side of San Francisco. But I still think that corner of the world could be like really amazing, and it's actually so expensive because it is amazing.
Totally.
I mean,
San Diego.
In that environment.
I asked Ion where the most beautiful, perfect place in the world is.
Enjoy all those parks.
Once. In 2015, I asked Ion where I should go live, and he mentioned some place on the coast right beside San Diego. That's the most perfect place to live. It's where I should, where I need to be. It's kind of cool. San Diego is the underrated part of California, they say. It's modest in size, but really cool. And not as superficial as L.A. or as expensive as San Francisco. And right next to Mexico. So now's the time.
Listen, and
5 years.
Do you know why were there so many fires?
Like, because it's the hotbed of energy in the world. Everything happens there. Like, everybody who's creative in the entire world wants to move to L.A. or wants to visit there or wants to go there. So it's just this crazy rush of energy. So the fire is going to attract it, right? And there's, like, Ion explains that about, like, how that works. Like, saying with the earthquakes in San Francisco, he's like, nobody would be there. They explain that in a video, in an audio clip I listened to, that everybody expects a fire around L.A. and in California, so that's why it happens. Just like earthquakes in San Francisco, everybody expects it. And so the focus and the attention is on earthquakes in San Francisco, and so earthquakes in San Francisco happen there. Just like fires in California, everybody expects a fire in California. The more they happen, the more people expect it, the more of them happen. Kind of like perpetuating episode of human creation. Also, fires happen every time I leave L.A. Every time I leave L.A., there's a fire or a shooting or something. So I take a little bit of responsibility for it, too.
Is that it? You ran out of topics?
Well, did you have anything to say, Bob?
No, I find it very interesting that he's such an insider.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we're talking about the place where, like, you see, for me, it's just when I think about it, like, the scale is at
California,
the most extreme. The scales of disparity, like, you know, $38 million buildings right next to, you know, right. Yeah, you're talking about you see these massive disparities because in the state of California, a city like
5 hours.
Yes, and that's why I said, for me, the whole environment was like I am commenting on many topics we have been talking about, because you have this the whole range of people and their power or not.
And it's interesting that these people are okay. These people, you know, are going to get by somehow, right? Like in Skid Row, as long as they've got a little screen with, you know, TV shows and radio coming in, right? They're mediated, so they're good. Yeah, they're poor. Okay, yes. But that's, I mean, they're
yes, and even before the first Spaniards making their missions there, the idea of California was like a place of abundance and gold and the place where maybe El Dorado was to be found, and there was the archetype that all these people going to California during the gold rush thought this is the place of the American dream of complete abundance.
It's still the last frontier. Still the last frontier.
Yes.
With the trope of manifest destiny.
There's a term.
It's a very special place.
There's a term that I just... Sorry.
Yes, it's the archetype of everything people think America is. You know, like the place of the American dream. The place where everybody wants.
And it's only...
And make it
only
and
possible
be famous
to live there.
And
it's only possible to live in California because of technology. It's the air conditioner that has allowed the entire settlement. Like, and it's like a very simple, simple thing that you like overlook. But without the air conditioner, nobody would be in L.A. Nobody would be in any part of the Southwest.
The, well, that's funny you say air conditioner, because in Canada, I think of the snowplow as what makes life possible up here right now for me, right? The invention of the Skidoo. Bombardier. We learn about Bombardier in school because he invented the Skidoo, which let people move around on top of snow, the motorized snow car, right? Skidoo.
Yeah.
Right. Snowmobile, rather. So I should say, right? Like, that's like part of Canadian history, right? So, same deal there, because of technology.
Probably. But at the same time, the technology of fire is what allows you to live in Canada during the hostile times of year. It's like the ability to heat your home, which is like an old technology, relatively speaking, to the air conditioner, which is like a 20th century phenomenon. Without it, it's really, really hard to live in the Southwest.
Absolutely. But, I mean, also you can't, have your horse and buggy move around with 6 feet of snow outside either, right? So
don't forget about huskies.
Yeah, that's true enough. Oh, no, thank God we don't need them anymore. There's a term, inferior good. Which is apparently, it's an economic term I learned today. Apparently, it's an economic term for. Okay, so this is an article by Andrew Yang, who's the Democratic, one of the Democrats running for president in 2020. And he wrote this article on Colette about video games and video game addiction. And it's really interesting because he's coming on pretty strongly about how, like, economics is showing that video games is causing men to drop out of the workplace. And, like, his whole platform is largely about changing to technology and how he's technologically literate, whereas most politicians in Washington aren't, and so that's how he's going to shake things up, right? He says here, just because we were talking about the screens in the tents in Skid Row, and I think we're right, and they watch so much TV because they're poor, right? But time spent playing video games is what's known in economic terms as an inferior good, which means the poorer you are, the more of it you consume. So inferior good is the term for media or anything else that only poor people do to access because it's free or cheap.
Is that something like in Mexico? You see, everybody has a TV or a radio,
right.
And they're always on everywhere because it's like a cheap activity that the whole family can engage and they don't really need to spend that much.
Yeah,
money.
Exactly. Oh, exactly.
I was in Peru, living in the Andes, in this really tall town, small town. High up in the Andes, and it was in 2009, so like smartphones weren't crazy around, and data still didn't exist in most places. And we used to go to one of the shops in town and crowd around this tiny TV and watch the soccer game together with a bunch of strangers. Well, not really strangers, but we wouldn't really communicate because we all spoke English and they spoke Spanish, but we'd gather around this tiny TV and watch football.
Sure.
The original football. It was like, and I wonder if that still happens now, you know, like almost 10 years later. I wonder if that is also an obsolete experience, but wasn't there. It was the way to live at that point. It was the idea of the center fire was still around the television, which was kind of cool.
Yeah, the hearth. Yeah, electric hearth. Everyone gathers around for their warmth. That's interesting. I mean, like, if you go to a sports bar, and most bars have sports, you're still going to watch sports, right? But just as likely, people are going to be sitting around with phones in their faces. But I guess I'm thinking in, like, I guess I'm in, like, you know, I'm not in Peru. I'm not in some place where it's, like, that would be the only. Yeah. I wonder, eh? Because smartphones are, like, they're probably expensive for, like, people in, like, but it's the only, it's the, you know, once you have it, it does everything. It's the only screen you need, right? So it's probably worth it. If people were, like, you worried about people, like, in Mexico in the 80s all having satellite dishes and stuff, like old school giant 8-foot satellite dishes so that they could pick up, you know, like, all
well,
of the,
now. I think it's one of the countries with the most people online, Mexico.
Oh, yeah?
Like, people are really into cell phones.
Oh, sure. Social media, of course. Yeah. That's all anyone uses
and
the internet for.
It's I think, one of the first or the second country with the most fake news, or where people are the most exposed to fake news because of that, too. Like, there are companies in Mexico making fake news.
That's oh, wow.
Making what?
Fake news.
Okay.
Like, yeah, people have, like, corporations where they make fake news, and they, the young people work there.
You're talking like clickbait sites?
Yes, I think
clickbait.
There is some, like, advice article about that, you know, the Vice magazine?
Vice, yes.
Canadian, another Canadian company. Like, from the same city as Pornhub, you have, like, political correct, ideological porn spread all over the world, thanks to Canada. Yeah.
That's one way to frame it, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, my professor's husband was one of the chief editors of Vice while I was in school in Montreal. But that was before they kicked... Yeah, just after they kicked Gavin McGinnis out of their circle because he was too radical with his thoughts.
Right, yeah.
The Canadian ethos, yeah.
Who was Catherine McGinnis?
Gavin McGinnis.
Gavin McGinnis, the Proud Boys, the creator of the Proud Boys.
What's that?
The men fraternity that believed
in... incels?
No, it's not incels. Those guys would be losers to Gavin McInnes. It's kind of like it was a total joke made up, like male chauvinist. Like, yeah, we're tough guys. Like, you know, the Proud Boys because they're proud boys, right? And you know, we love our country. But it was basically a parody. But then it became a real thing. Like, anyway, and now, but all the all the feminists and social justice warriors all call it a misogynistic, male chauvinist hate group, right? And he just got kicked off YouTube. Yeah, what was the initiation?
The initiation is you have to, like, renounce like, I do not believe in feminism, I do not believe in this, blah, 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 on your Facebook, and it's like, I am now a Proud Boy, and you have to, like, document that as your initiation, and then you have to, like, go meet some Proud Boys, and if they, like you, they then go and beat you up, where you have to recite breakfast cereals. You have to continue to recite breakfast cereals the entire time you're being beat up. Because breakfast cereal is like the American man phenomenon. Like, obviously, it's a joke, right?
Yeah.
But yet people take it like so seriously.
Yep. And so this has caused, like 2 years ago, maybe? Yeah, and I mean, so now everyone who has known Gavin McInnes has to renounce him now. This is some of the internet drama, the shit that you can watch, right? Like, he's been kicked off of YouTube, and everyone who's worked with him is being pressured by all these feminists or their bosses or anyone else, like, you know, oh, you're going to be in hot water if you don't disavow Gavin McInnes and, you know, sever ties. And, like, Milo Yiannopoulos had to, like, I think he was one of them, had to be like, my lawyers have advised me to formally disavow Gavin McInnes and, you know, and the Proud Boys. And it's ironic because the day before he was like, shame on Jordan Peterson for disavowing me. And then he goes and disavows Gavin McInnes, right? So it's like, it's all this shit, right? This is the sort of petty squabbling that these fractious ideological battles. And yeah, it was a joke to begin with, right? Like, it's amazing how all these small, petty things are exploding on the global scale. It's like there's nothing better for anyone to argue about. This has to be the most important freaking life or death battle. And
this was Lawrence Professor?
No.
There's like derivatively like 3 degrees of separation. Yes. Like my professor's husband was the chief editor of Vice at the time that they kicked him out.
But he was a founding member. He was a founding member of Vice. Yeah.
He's a founding member of Gavin Vice or what?
Gavin was a founding member of Vice magazine.
Oh.
Like he was like one of the original dudes. Yeah.
90s punk movement. And he's like, what happens with the punk movement in the 90s is either you moved on and you became a socialist pansy or you became an anarchist libertarian. And I'm the only one that became an anarchist libertarian and everybody else just went PC.
Why are the feminists mad about people who don't believe in feminism?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
See, hidden ground.
Smoking.
No, because everyone... oh, my God, because everyone...
Roll
has,
it, well, man.
Yeah.
It's only a thought. I mean, what the fuck are people thinking? These guys don't go and act out in parties and beat women up or anything.
No. If you don't believe in feminism, you are a threat to their safety. They don't feel safe around you. They're taught to feel all of the symptoms of trauma. They're conditioned to feel traumatized in the presence of anyone who could hit them at any time, right? If they're the sort of person who doesn't
believe in feminism, right?
They are.
The problem is they attack people all the time.
Ridiculous. Well, because they're a bunch of soccer hooligans. Michael just said the Proud Boys sounds like the present timing Fight Club. And so, yeah, it's like an ironic joke Fight Club that then a whole bunch of guys did take seriously because there's enough weirdos out there who are going to go out there and fucking beat people up like soccer hooligans.
In Canada, they beat all those Native Americans up on Canada Day a few years back.
Oh, yeah.
2 or 3 years. And they were, like, denouncing their rights. And then, like, Gavin McInnes at that time in Rebel Media with his, like, whole channel and everything, I used to watch a lot of what he said because they were very good points in my mind at the time. And, I didn't, like, drink the Kool-Aid. I just listened to his perspective. But anyways, and he's like, yo, this is, like, ridiculous because, like, you guys actually sold that land out from the feet of a different nation, and it wasn't actually your land, but you sold it to the English, and, like, nobody has any jurisdiction over Halifax whatsoever because of the way you guys double-played each other. Trust me, my wife is Native. She is Mi'kmaq. Like, this is the story of what actually happened. So, like, these guys were fighting it because the Native Americans were disrespecting Canada on Canada's birthday, and, yeah, they should attack and defend their country. Why were you? And they're like, blah, 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 blah. It was a big thing. For a second, and then people forgot. as it goes.
All right, so what's the grievance right now? Just Trump? What's the grievance today? What are people being organized around? What are people being organized around?
By the Proud Boys or Gavin McInnes?
No, what's the new Fed? Gavin's gone, right? Nobody's doing that anymore.
Well, yeah,
Jordan
now
Peterson,
people are...
Jordan Peterson.
Jordan Peterson's still big. It's the intellectual dark web now. There's a whole bunch of people who are under the umbrella of the IDW. And otherwise, people are noticing the censorship of platforms like Patreon and Facebook and YouTube, right? And so the new thing right now is people are starting to, in the last few months, really realize, like, hey, like, what are the rules for what gets banned? Like, why did Gavin McInnes get banned? And you see, the thing is, these fights have already been happening for 30 years on a very small parochial scale on every single website I've ever been a fucking member of, right? Back on, you know, every website I'm on, right? The Star Trek fan community of, like, you know, 500 people, right? It's like, hey, you aren't enforcing the rules properly. Why did the moderator ban me but not ban him? What are the rules? You're censoring, blah, 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 blah. Right? I've seen this fight play out a million times on the small scale. So it's like, what's old is new again. Just now it's on a massive world-changing scale of the biggest websites on Earth, right, with a population of 2 billion on it. But it's still the same stupid arguments. Oh, why did you ban him but you didn't ban her? Right?
Yeah.
I demand the moderators, you know, back more consistently, right? Like, fuck off. Same fight, only now it's like life or death for the fate of the planet. Great.
The banning. Okay.
And, you know, I wonder when... I don't know if you have seen this documentary, Generation Wealth.
No, we haven't.
No.
No?
No.
No, like, what do the young generations expect or want? Like, before people were into making money or having stuff and buying a house.
I say it's geographically dependent.
No, literally, here's the point. So they were into wanting a house. Then what happened?
Yeah, what do the younger generations aspire?
Well, do you know?
No, I'm asking you.
Well, what does Generation Wealth tell us?
Well,
like...
No, you saw the movie. What's it tell us? Is it out of date?
No, that's a documentary about people in California.
Mm-hmm.
And that are, like, extreme wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
And how decadent they can be.
In their expenditures.
So yeah. What's the movie Crazy Rich Asians?
We're in a point in which we're like thinking about what if all this human creation about what are we here for? Like,
you're saying everybody's wondering that?
Like, we have these higher ideals of something we call ascension and taking our power back and recollected lucidity.
Mm-hmm.
The knowing and yeah, just
I would
by,
say.
By becoming
Wait.
Healthier. Like, we already see some changes.
Yeah.
It's not just like some type of utopia.
Right. Sounds like the kids can retrieve anything. There's no general trend. You're just talking about rich people. The younger people are either right, left, center, or Neater or Wall Street. You know, they're all over the place.
It's like the power is not about making money.
In the Generation Wealth documentary, that's the point?
No. In the Generation Wealth is actually that's not the point of existence. You know, just trying
yeah, but
to
who says that?
And,
are you quoting someone?
No, they just showed the people and their decadence.
Right, so they're into wealth.
Yes, but they're not actually like.
You're censoring the only people, person that actually understands the generation right now. You're just being a YouTube.
You're saying that they're not, they don't have any goals. They don't know how to keep making money. They're just spending what they got.
It's a platitude. I think
is that what you're saying, Rossi? They are interested in spending and they don't know how to make it.
No, I'm asking them, like, what would be the American dream now for younger generations?
It's fragmented. Whatever weird myth that influences them.
You won't let me talk for my own generation.
No, we'll get to you. Roxy brought up this topic. I'm going to find out what the topic is. So you bring up this documentary, and that shows the kids don't know what they want.
No, the documentary is about very wealthy people in America and how decadent they can be.
In what they spend, what they consume.
In everything. It's like somebody that talks about that documentary says it's like... some type of moral sickness or cancer or something like that.
Someone says that's what they're expressing, a moral sickness.
Yeah. Yeah, like... it's really... like when one watches that documentary, what one doesn't feel like I want to be that rich.
Right.
It's like you see these people and you see how miserable they are.
It shows them being miserable.
Yes, like the way they talk and how they talk about money and their life is. It's really pathetic.
They got enemy. They got boredom.
Yes, and in some cases, because this photographer has been doing this for many years.
Yeah.
Like, he has been following up some of the subjects. And some people that were very, very rich lost...
everything.
Everything because of the crisis.
And what happened to them?
Yes, and they realized that when they had money, they thought they needed more.
Mm-hmm.
And when they had more, they always needed more. Like, mm-hmm. they never achieved
right.
happiness. And they thought, if I have more, I will be happy. But it never happened. So... because everything in society is about profit. It's like the motivation behind most people. It's like, I think we have to evaluate and change what are we looking for.
Right.
So what would be the alternative? Like... that was what the hippie generations were trying to find out.
Yeah.
but at the end, it all ended up like very bad. And the corporations took over the whole environment.
To keep the sensory stimulation going. People want sensory stimulus. They think it's going somewhere. And they've got to drop off. If not, they'll high and dry. They got to go to a kind of yoga. They got to stop.
Do you think the solution would be like having a universal salary for everybody?
Well, you could have whole parts of the world do that. Other parts not. See, there's no solution for the whole world. I think I just saw an American town is now creating a guaranteed income in their town. So you've got heavy fragmentation. There's going to be different kinds of solutions everywhere, done differently on bigger, smaller scale. See? So you don't look for one thing to impose on everybody. You just know that people are going to improvise all kinds of things.
Yes, and what would you say would be the way to make America great again?
Well, you know, find them. But that ain't going to go great now. So I bow out until they're ready for me. Or I ain't trying to get it on a big scale.
I was interested in your question, Roxy, about what the American dream is for young people. But I was wondering what Lauren was going to say first, because he said...
Yeah, we have a young person here who claims to know what his generation is into.
So what's your American dream, Bob?
Yeah.
I don't think like that. Like my American dream, there's no such thing. I don't believe I'm in America. I don't have any parameters. I don't make visual definitions of what I'm doing. My mind is very
weak. Like a California surfer.
Yeah, if you say I am, some people think that. But I'm not a California surfer. But some people would just see that part. I can be seen as all kinds of people, all kinds of types, by different people who see me in different ways. You know?
So in the past 4 years, I've lived in about 8 or 9 completely different context and environments.
Okay.
I was living in Europe with the youth. Before that, I was in Montreal being an artist. Then I went to LA and I was with artists. And then I went to Buffalo and I was a bartender. And then I went to Napa Valley and I worked in the wine industry. Then I went to Toronto and I was an artist. And then I went to Golden and I was just a vagabond. And then I went to Banff. And then I went back to Napa, California. But I was working in the service industry. And then from there, I went back to my small town and tried to make that into a life. And then I went back to Los Angeles, but then I worked in art again, but in a different context of art and a different kind of part of the city. In the meantime, I went back and forth and all over the place. And there are a variety, much like what Bob said, it's very, very localized. And the American dream, and within my generation, is based on where you live and where you want to go to, because we are the first generation that has the ability to go across the planet for $300, right? It costs no money for me to go to Madrid.
You know, they're planning the Star City in Mars.
I have friends that were, I also lived with engineers one of my times that I was living in California. After I lived with the artists, I lived with a bunch of rocket scientists that were sending probes up into Mars. So I understood that reality of the new future. And there's like a variety of different, everybody that I lived with was a different set of motives and goals and ideas of what was right, what was wrong, what they wanted in terms of ambition. There's no consistent anything through I'm still in my 20s, and I started this whole trip when I was like, for the 10 years, basically my entire decade of 20s, I've just been moving around to different environments and experiencing what all of these young people.
And a lot
want.
Of people are doing that, a few generation, right?
It is true. But also, if you find a place that you like, you stay there. But that dictates what your ambitions are. So there's like the transients, but then there's also the people that are just like, no, I want nothing more than to just serve tables and ski down the hills when it's winter and then hike up them when it's summertime. And I'm totally fine with that. And so we don't actually look that far ahead of our own bliss, unless you're in a city like LA, where everything you do is based on who you want to be, and you're just blinded by ambition. And that's a whole other chapter of people my age who are, like, desperate trying. And then there's also the rich people that don't have to try anything and do whatever they want and go wherever they want, and they're just, like, delaying it until they take over the family business. And so, I mean, I've also been in that contingent, too, and been friends with those people. And, I mean, you seen the movie Crazy Rich Asians? You know that movie? Anybody hear about it?
I heard about it.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
It's awesome. It's a great example of one chapter of where we are. I would say that the quadrophrenia describes my generation perfectly. If you don't have ambition, move to a small town that's beautiful, and then you just do outdoors tasks. Like, you just do one sort of outdoor recreation or another, and then just make end meet for you to be able to do that. And then you can be connected to the rest of the world. I think the reason why people are so satisfied to live in these small communities of utopia is because they can connect through the internet to the rest of the world, and so they don't have to be with the rest of the world. The only thing I haven't done is gone into a small part of middle America and trying to live that life. I don't really know what the youth do there, but it's probably much like my small town in Canada, where they just are just buying into the old way of doing things. The literate get commitment, this is what you do, just stick with it whether you like it or not, you know, and just whatever, wait till you can retire and die. Is there still enough people my age that are following in those footsteps?
I find what you just said, like all of that, very...
Clinton, you're too low. Fix your mic.
Okay, how's that? That was really interesting, because, like, I have not traveled very much at all. Like, I've lived in two places, a small town in Canada and a city, which was Ottawa, which isn't a very, like, big city even, right? So what you said about people feeling happy in their small town because they can connect to the rest of the world is very true. But without the actual, I don't have the actual experience of being able to contrast and compare. Like, for instance, when Roxy was talking about the feel of San Francisco, and when you were describing being able to feel how, you know, like, the city felt compared to that city, the hustle and bustle of New York versus everyone being shut in, and right, like, I haven't acquired that level of senses even for, like, the cityscape urban environment for lack of having experienced it. So I am very much connected to the whole world. But all of that is directly mediated, and so it's all very, as Bob would say, chip body and quadrophenic as hell, but lacking any sort of grounding in actually, like, knowing on a sensory level that it's real, or being able to appreciate what it is that, you know, is being encoded in the movies. Like, what life is like in New York is not something that I can watch a movie and then relate to any experience in New York. So I get the sense of what it is entirely as told to me through the symbolism or the artistic, you know, all the, you know, creative forms of the media itself. And so I really am into McLuhan exactly because I'm trying to understand why it is. It's helped me understand that my own lack of experience, my own lack of travel and getting out there, like, is one of the reasons I look at things the way that I do. That is my media bias, because everything that I know is virtual, right, so to speak. So, like, you're very much more grounded in the social, in the environment, than I am. And so when you talk about things, it comes from a very different perspective that I have, right? So that's just something interesting that I've been realizing listening to our talk tonight. So that's really cool.
Yeah, you and Lauren are the same age.
But that is also relative, because it's not the same to be there as a tourist than, you know, really experiencing the cities and living there. Like,
that's a good point,
I mean,
yeah.
I find so interesting all the comments that Lauren, or who was the other?
Lauren
was talking about, and all the insights of California.
what you're saying, Lauren, is not doing tourism. Is that what you're saying?
One of them lives there, and he knows the area very well. And I sort of idealize California and San Francisco. But
right.
He experiences more, you know, by living there. And so he doesn't have such an idealized point of view. You know,
you're talking about Lauren?
Well, he has been more the homeless and all these problems.
Well, not homeless. He worked in different places.
His opinion of the homeless, or no, not of them, but the situations that caused it. Just, you know, the fact that he's got the inside scoop on all these cities, I agree, is interesting. Or he's got his own, you know, established opinion from having lived there.
It's a bias,
just like any other. Just it was my personal perception that I find every small town I go to, I cannot connect with anybody my age there because they don't have the same set of ambitions. Yet, at the same time, I go to L.A. and I'm overwhelmed by the desperation of everybody my age because they all have too much ambition. And it's like,
oh man,
it's like a crazy level of contrast. Buffalo, New York, the perfect size. A little bit of ambition, a little bit of not ambition. It's like, that's the kind of way you got to be. No, I'm just joking. Buffalo's not perfect at all, or even great, but it's okay. I want to go to New Orleans. That's the last place in America that I want to go experience.
Because
I hear that it has a crazy vibrancy of life.
Maui does.
If you have no ambition and you want to just surf the waves and work a service job at my age, I am sure Hawaii would be a great place to live.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying New Orleans has a vibe like Maui, you suspect?
More music, more artistic, more creative. I mean, it's the capital of mixology, it's the jazz, it's the... They have multiple cultures. They have... It's like the closest to Canada that you're going to get because they have the Acadian, they have the Creole and the Cajun, so they have, like, two languages, two cultures represented. It's like, and then they have all the Latin people as well, and they have the American, and you have the urban, and you also have the back, outback, and the rural America. It's like everything is in Louisiana. It has, like, all the different kinds of America, plus more than the rest of America has.
Hmm. Well, we won't know what it means till Roxy goes there. She's our barometer. We'll let her do the traveling.
What?
Just a different perspective.
I'm not going
to New Orleans.
I'll go move there, and then, Roxy, you can go be a tourist there, and then we can talk about our various perceptions.
You know, I was telling some friends in San Francisco, because a friend of mine said she had some food and she wanted me to look with her. And, you know, she took her car. She was looking for some homeless people to give them the food.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, in other cities, we feed the little dogs. Not the dog.
In other cities, you see little dogs? What did you just say?
Ducks. You know, the quack quack ducks.
Oh, ducks. What about these ducks?
I told my friend, in other cities, we feed the little dogs. And here, you look for
homeless
to feed them. And my friends found that so funny. They were laughing like for a long time, and even days later they would start laughing. And I was like, that was not a joke. They found that really, really funny, and I think it was actually not that they really found it funny, but that there was some type of nervousness.
Nervous about people.
That. Yeah, it was really weird.
Yeah, they did not want to. Oh, nervous about you? Or the ones who feed the ducks are nervous about people?
No, I don't know the situation. Like they think they're doing something good. They don't throw food away, but they give it to some people.
That's pretty nice. That's pretty good. Did you find somebody? Did you do it?
Yes, there's a lot of homeless people, but...
Well, you just drive up, stop, and ask them.
The good thing will be that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, that doesn't have to happen.
Or some other type of solution.
Yeah.
But,
remember, we're in the age of chaos.
Those are the type of weird things that one... encounters in America, this big contrast of wealth. And
that's a good story. They find people feeding ducks and not feeding people. It's absurd. Why not feed people? Right?
Well, I don't really know, but they
no, what else does your story mean?
I don't know.
Don't give up.
I comment very funny.
Right, but well, what's the reasoning? They just think it's crazy that people feed ducks and not humans.
I don't know.
You don't know. They were laughing. They sounded funny.
Yeah.
Well, my explanation stands. All right? On that story, my explanation is the reason for the joke.
Yes, I was thinking maybe we could listen to this photographer.
All right. Autographer.
Her name is Photographer, the one that made the Generation Wealth. Just talk about her project.
Oh, okay. All right. So, yes, I started to look at that.
I'm just going to play it, what she said.
Over the last 25 years. But this project is not about actual wealth. To clarify, it's really about the influence of affluence. It's about our aspiration to wealth, its connection to our identity and that of the American dream, and the way we emulate it and package it and export our notions of it, and the contagious virus that is the addictive culture of consumerism. My work considers wealth very broadly defined. So I'm including the currency of fame, the currency of branding, the currency of the body, the currency of youth. Of course, I'm also talking about the currency of having money and what that brings, but just as importantly, the value of looking like you do, the concept of fake it till you make it, as Future the rapper and many other subjects told me on this journey. I realized that this wasn't just the time that I worked and the themes that I followed, but that actually there was this kind of seismic shift in both our values and our culture, and saw that we had gone from a culture defined by the Protestant ethic and the value of hard work and discipline and frugality to a culture that prized bling and celebrity and narcissism. And to illustrate that, I have a photograph from my first project in 1987 on the left about the French aristocracy. See, I was interested in this idea of a upper class that did not have money, because many of them didn't have money anymore, and this idea that class wasn't necessarily defined by money. And then on the other hand, on the right is Suzanne, a socialite in Toronto, who's married to a media mogul and is kind of like the new princess, and she's wearing a Valentino gown, and her fashion and design muse is a character from Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, truly scrumptious. And here's Suzanne again in one of her four seasonal closets, and the orange boxes are her Hermes Birkin bags. So when I was putting this together, I kept thinking about the elements that represented this sea change. And I thought about this recurring Birkin bag, which for anybody who happily doesn't know, is a Hermes designer bag that can be purchased for five figures. And this was an oft-repeated reference from unexpectedly diverse subjects throughout the world. And besides this surprising knowledge about a five-digit bag, I also became obsessed by the fact that Kim Kardashian, who I first photographed at 12, became a mainstream star by starting with a sex tape. This is Kim at 12, and this is Kim 16 years later. While this work is not just about the Birkin bag, Kim Kardashian, or the rise of Donald Trump, it is most definitely about the culture that made all three possible. And to represent Donald Trump, I'm going to show a picture of David Siegel from The Queen of Versailles, because he has a similar aesthetic of luxury with a gold throne and also they both dated Jackie Siegel. So this is me at three. And I grew up in kind of hippie times in Venice before it was gentrified. And my parents were professors and were influenced by the counterculture. And my mother was doing cross-cultural field work in a Maya Indian village when I was little. And I then studied visual anthropology at Harvard and started by interning at National Geographic. And my first project was actually with my mother. She was the writer and I was the photographer, and we were documenting a Maya Indian village in the highlands of Chiapas. And I started thinking about the world that I had grown up in Los Angeles, and how L.A. culture, youth culture specifically, was kind of being exported and influencing other kids around the world through shows like Beverly Hills 90210. And I started thinking that this center of media and the kind, some of the things I had seen growing up were actually worthy of the same kind of serious study that anthropologists and photojournalists usually give to foreign cultures. So I went back to my high school. This is from Crossroads, 1992. This is the graduation. And started my first book, Fast Forward, about how kids were influenced by the values of materialism, the cult of celebrity, and the importance of image. And one of the things I was looking at the time was the influence of the media and the way kids from very different backgrounds were experiencing a kind of homogenization of culture through the shared media. And when I was just starting this project, I was walking down the alley and these three kids said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm doing a project about growing up in L.A. And so they said, "Well, then you have to photograph money. That's what it's all about." And they pulled out these dollar bills, and it wasn't until I got home and looked at the slides that I realized they were holding up $100 bills. So the work became very quickly about the early loss of innocence in the media-saturated society, in the consumer society. This is a three-year-old at Barney's in Beverly Hills, and this is actually the same girl. When she was 16, she was in a film I made called Kids and Money, which is also part of the Generation Wealth show. And this is Beverly Hills High Senior Ditch Day, where all the kids ditch school, go to the beach for the day. And Mijanu, in the foreground, was awarded Best Physique at Beverly Hills High School. And she was actually not from a rich family. And I started doing interviews that went with these pictures, which was a practice I continued all the way through. And in her interview, she talked about actually how hard it was to not be from a rich family but be in this milieu and to not have the clothes and the cars that the other kids had. But she also recognized that her beauty was a kind of passport into the popular clique. This is Emily, who is 10, at the Peninsula Hotel, where she and her family were living in a $3,000 a night suite for the last 3 months when I took this picture. And actually, they were kind of slumming it because their two mansions had been seized by the federal government for tax evasion, and so they all moved into the hotel with the help in the presidential suite. Her father ended up doing 6 years in prison. And this is Adam, who was 13, at a bar mitzvah party where the mother of the bar mitzvah boy rented out the Whiskey A Go-Go nightclub on the Sunset Strip and brought in go-go girls to dance with the kids. And Adam Adam's interview was one of the first I did, and it was so kind of interesting and pivotal for me because he said, well, you have to spend like $50,000 on a bar mitzvah or you're shit out of luck. But then he also said that he felt money ruin kids, and he felt money ruined him. But I also...